you. Thank you so much for joining us for today's panel. This is the Mormon Sex Ed Project. We are going to be having a discussion of how to raise Mormon youth with a healthy concept of their sexual selves. We want to take a moment and remind you, of course, to turn off your cell phone or anything else that might make noise unexpectedly. And especially for this panel, I encourage you to pull out a piece of paper and a pen to kind of jot down notes that you might want to share later. Totally up to you, but I thought I'd give you the heads up. So it's a little unusual to give a biography for yourself, but that's what I'm charged with doing. So my name is Sarah K.S. Hanks. I'm a writer, reader, and doula in training from St. George, Utah. And my husband and I reside in Renton, Washington as of 2 weeks ago and in Provo, Utah, basically until then. We hope to take on parenthood and pet ownership in the near future, now that we live in the Pacific Northwest. I've been a gospel doctrine teacher, a nursery leader, and an assistant girls' camp director in my time as a Mormon. So I think I've pretty much cornered like all the callings that I really want. But I will say that that elusive Young Womanhood Recognition Award has just always been beyond my reach. So I'll apologize for that from the get-go. I also want to introduce my fellow panelists. First of all, we have Chelsea Lane Campbell. Chelsea has a BA in English from Southern Utah University and is currently pursuing an MFA in writing at Texas State University. A newlywed and feminist in Zion, with a perpetual interest in gender studies and the LDS Church, she is a self-proclaimed sexual health and happiness advocate. Kristen Hastings hails from the delicious drizzle of Portland, Oregon. She has a BA in art history from BYU and an MA in art history from the University of York, England. Her colorful and dynamic spiritual history includes her conversion to the church at the age of 11, as well as family members who are Jewish, Catholic, Buddhist, and agnostic. She is addicted to design blogs, is an incurable Anglophile, and just returned to the States after teaching art to 40 kindergartners in Seoul, South Korea. She is devoted to supporting and empowering women within and without the church. So, with that, I think that we will go ahead and get started. I'll be starting off today's panel with some basic explanations of what we're calling the Mormon Sex Ed Project. What it is, why the three of us are involved with it, and what we hope to accomplish with today's discussion and with the project as a whole. Simply put, Simply put, the Mormon Sex Ed Project is our attempt to create a resource for Mormon parents that will help them teach their kids about sex in a healthy, positive, open, and faithful way. We believe that addressing these issues with one's kids does take a lot of courage, and for most people, it also takes some tools and some outside support. And though we can't provide the courage, we can help with the tools and the support. Our current vision for this resource is a complimentary book and website. It will focus, first of all, on values and parenting approaches, followed by direct instruction and guidelines on a wide variety of sexual topics. We hope to synthesize gospel teachings, scientific findings, and developmental psychology in order to educate parents on how they can handle a wide variety of sexual issues. We want to do our part to switch the conversation from a fear-based lecture format to a love-based discussion in families, which we believe is the ideal place to gain foundational knowledge on all facets of sexuality. So you might be wondering what exactly qualifies us to take on this task. What credentials make us worthy to create this resource? For one thing, we are not parents, and that's something that we think about. And we also can't boast degrees or specialized training in sex education practices. However, there are a few qualifications, a few arrows in our quiver that we feel very strongly about and think are worth mentioning. We are Mormons, and we have been for a long time, so we have a real and a deep interest in serving this community. We care about sex and sexuality and sexual health, and we have studied these topics extensively. We like words. We are educated and well-practiced in employing them. We love to conduct research, which is important in this case because we see our job as needing to compile the best that's out there instead of creating it from scratch. We are still young enough to have vivid memories and potent opinions of the sex education we received while we were growing up, but we're also at stages in our lives when we are seeing the consequences and the real-life application of the instruction we received in an adult context. As a final qualification, I think it would be appropriate to quote Doctrine and Covenants, Section 4. If ye have desires to serve God, ye are called to the work. And faith, hope, charity, and love, with an eye single to the glory of God, qualify him or her for the work. I have seen and I have a testimony that a way to serve God and glorify God is to serve one another and use our talents to lift one another. And since my eye is single to that, I have decided to trust the promise that faith, hope, charity, and love will qualify me and will help us in preparing us for this work. Sex education in the Mormon community, well, I have a metaphor. I have an object lesson. And I can't say for sure if it was my Mormon dad or the Mormon church that instilled in me like a real gravitation towards metaphors and object lessons for principles. But however it happened, I definitely am pulled that way. So I will say that sex education in the Mormon community is a little bit like a piñata that busts open with candy and sparkly treasures and all the things you would expect in your average piñata, but that also contains some not-so-great things. And you can think of those not-so-great things in any way you like. Maybe they're the little, like, cheap pencils or the stale candy that is, like, useless and outdated. But the way that I chose to think about the bad stuff in a piñata was actually as thumbtacks. Stuff that you don't want in a piñata at all, stuff that you don't want around children, but that in this case are definitely a part of the package. To say that sex education in our church is either totally perfect or totally broken would be inaccurate. Sex education for Mormons, of course, isn't a slam dunk right now, but in our opinion, it's also not a lost cause. There are beautiful things in this piñata of ours, teachings and views that really shine out. For one thing, our doctrine teaches that these physical bodies we have are gifts, that they are made in the image of heavenly parents, that bodies are inherited as rewards, both when we come to earth and when we reach the celestial kingdom. Bodies are good and precious and divine, and if we believe that, then certainly that view should give us a heightened understanding of all the things that our bodies can do, including their ability to be sexual. That view should allow us to leap over ideas of the body's inherent dirtiness. Our doctrine also teaches an immense reverence and gratitude for the gift of agency, the ability to direct our own lives and make our own choices. This view should give us an incredible sense of empowerment when it comes to our sexuality, because we know that it, too, is part of our stewardship and that no one else can possibly be responsible for the choices that we need to make. A natural extension of this belief is respect for the agency of others and a conviction not to violate that agency with force or manipulation. And this really lends itself to a disdain of sexual abuse, sexual coercion, sexual assault, and it should allow us to see right through the victim blaming that is so prevalent in today's rhetoric. The final advantage I'll mention is the equality, or at least the professed equality, between men and women when it comes to sexual expectations and responsibilities in the law of chastity. While elsewhere in the temple there are similar but ultimately different covenants for men and women, the law of chastity is identical between the sexes. This gives us a great opportunity to avoid the double standards that can really damage sexual relationships and identities. So if that comprises some of the candy and the sparkly doodads in our piñata, then what are the thumbtacks that hurt us and annoy us? For me, there's the sometimes overemphasized bit about how the natural man or woman is an enemy to God, leading us to wonder if our natural sexual desires are enemies as well. There are lessons about licked cupcakes and prophetic counsels about dirty flowers and objects lessons about nails pounded into wooden boards. There are scare tactics and attempts to shame young people into virginity. Sometimes we're successful with that and sometimes we're not. It's kind of a raw deal either way. There is silence about safe sex practices and a fixation on the dangers of pornography. There is ignorance about sexual orientation. There are double standards, even though there shouldn't be, that come from society rather than the spirit. There are words that never get defined or never even spoken. For many Mormon families, there is an absence of sexual education at home. Simultaneously, there is an aversion to sexual education at school. The most notable thumbtack in my life thus far has been a feeling of negativity and danger when it comes to sex, and how that feeling can hamper healthy intimacy in marriage. So when I look at the whole picture of sex education, or at least the whole part of the picture that I am privy to, I am of mixed emotions. I have mixed emotions. I am mournful and I am discouraged by what I see, but I'm also hopeful and about the possibilities and encouraged by some of the trends that I've noticed. The good and the bad of sex education is really all mixed together right now in our community. And what we hope to do with the Mormon Sex Ed Project is sift through what we have, separate it, and then present the best information out there to the courageous parents in our community who already want to help their kids be sexually safe and sexually happy and healthy and empowered. The life of any present-day Mormon is a practice in remembering some teachings and forgetting some other ones. Or at least, if not forgetting, then at least de-emphasizing. We latch onto some ideas, perhaps an avoidance of rated R movies, and we gloss over other teachings, like the Council Against Recreational Hunting, which came from Spencer W. Kimball, George Q. Cannon, and Joseph Fielding Smith. This selective memory is, of course, not limited to the Mormon community. It's not even limited to the Christian community. And in my opinion, there is everything right with being choosy about what advice you will obey and what opinions you'll adopt and what ideas you're going to reject or overlook. But it is a matter of being choosy, not of being cowardly and shying away from the teachings that we think would be good but just seem too scary. So let's apply this to the sex education pinata. It has both candy and thumbtacks. Just as the church's approach to sex education has beautiful love-based things and unhealthy fear-based things. When it comes to our kids, I think we want to reward them with candy rather than threaten them with thumbtacks. We want to reward them with candy rather than threaten them with thumbtacks. And we want to educate them with the most correct and most appropriate information on sex that we can possibly find. This resource that we're hoping to make won't overlook the thumbtacks. Rather, it will point out the ways in which these teachings are perhaps skewed or fear-based, and it will encourage parents to evaluate for themselves whether that teaching has a place in their family. So we won't turn a blind eye to the things that are broken, but ultimately, what we really want to do is track down and identify the most wonderful, most loving pieces that Mormonism has to offer, and we want to promote those. Of course, we are still in the early stages of creating this resource and finding these treasures, but we know they're there. You can take a look at just some of the teachings from A Parent's Guide, which is a resource that the church publishes in order to help parents teach their kids about sex. So these great teachings already exist. We want to shine a light on them. We want to say, hey, check it out. The church counsels us to have open communication with our children about sex and intimacy. And this is why that advice makes so much sense from a psychological perspective. We want to say, oh, observe this. The church teaches us to teach our children the real parts of, like, the real names for the parts of their bodies. And we think that advice is spot on. So let's give you some tools that will make that more practical and less intimidating for your family. if in every area of life some things are going to fall by the wayside and some things are going to stick in our minds, then we want the things that stick to be healthy, doctrinally sound, loving teachings about the gift of sexuality. As part of explaining our project, I would like to talk a bit about my fellow panelists and how today's panel came to be. Chelsea and I have been good friends for many years, and we have a shared sense that the Mormon approach to sexuality is tangled and incomplete right now. And that has been to the detriment of many people that we have known personally, and even to the detriment of us as individuals. We've discussed this topic between ourselves repeatedly over the years, and several months ago, we formalized our intentions to offer a solution to the problem rather than to stay casual observers. It was immediately clear to us that we needed more voices, more input, a wider range of experience and thought. So we proposed a panel to Sunstone for the express purpose of hearing from you and talking with you. It was at this point that Chrisanne joined us. I met Chrisanne in January through LDS Wave and found her to be wonderful, as I'm sure you will. She has this incredible way with words that really distills and crystallizes everything your heart wanted to say but really couldn't find the speech for. And I knew that she would have valuable and pure things to add about today's topics. So we are very pleased that she is joining us for today's panel. Chrisanne and Chelsea might tell you more about their motivations and their experiences just as they deem it necessary, but for my part, I will say that I am motivated to make a sex ed resource for Mormon parents because I wish my own Mormon parents had had one. I'm not really thinking about this project as a parent. I'm thinking of it as a child and thinking about what I wanted my parents to have access to. I wish I could have learned at home from my parents what I ended up learning from kids on the playground and from internet chat rooms and standards nights. I wish my parents had had the tools and the persistent encouragement to do the whole sex ed thing with me, just to even tell me what my genitals were called or explain the broad strokes of where babies come from. Those were conversations that didn't take place in my home, and I've wondered sometimes why that is. I've always had to guess. But earlier today, I was talking with my mom on the phone, and I asked her, and she shared with me a lot of reasons why she and my father didn't handle sex education with me, like, in person, I guess. They were reasons that I really sympathized with. It wasn't about a lack of love. It wasn't about them not being involved with me, because they were very involved in my life. But I think it was because they didn't recognize the importance, and also because they didn't have the tools to decide that the awkwardness was just, it was worth facing and worth handling. I am motivated to make a sex ed resource because I deserved a healthier concept of sex than the one that I was conditioned into. The thing I learned most solidly about sex while I was growing up was that it was an expression of lust, that any young man who wanted to have sex with me was acting out of selfish desires and didn't really love me. And that made sense in my spiritual framework because premarital sex would be destructive to my spirit, and obviously anyone who loved me wouldn't want to destroy my spirit. But I didn't see enough of a distinction between sex that is casual or selfish or premature and sex that is loving and faithful and life-affirming. So I grew up, I matured into my late teenage years, I was uber protective of my chastity, even going so far as to make the personal standard that I wouldn't have my first kiss or my first boyfriend until I was done with high school. And I did meet that standard by the narrow margin of, I think, 12 hours after the commencement ceremony. I did what the prophets and my young women leaders suggested by dating young men who would respect my standards. And not one of my boyfriends ever pressured me to have sex, which I'm sincerely grateful for. I'm grateful also to have been raised in a system where I was taught to demand that sort of respect in my dating relationships. I met and I fell in love with the man that I wanted to marry, and we made it to our wedding night, virginities intact. We bridled our passions, and we put off the natural man and woman, and we kept our hands to ourselves right into the temple. We were victorious in the style of a new era, happily ever after. Two beautiful young people who had kept themselves clean and pure and would now proceed to all the blessings. But unlike those past boyfriends of mine, my husband did want to have sex with me, and I did want to have sex with him, and we were excited for that. And I mean, we should have been. It's a wonderful part of life and a wonderful part of being in love. And I really did genuinely feel that way until the part where it became real and I was actually married and sex was actually an issue that I had to confront. Somehow I couldn't make the transition and I couldn't flip the switch that people say you just need to flip when you get married. I could know in my head that my husband wasn't trying to hurt me or use me when he wanted to have sex with me, but I couldn't really believe that in my heart for a very, very long time. And it did take time, and it took counseling, and it took hard work and tears. And I believe it was so difficult because I was taught a very narrow and very slanted understanding of what sex can be. And I was taught that understanding predominantly in church settings. I have to say, though, that when I was struggling with this and I went into two wonderful bishops who I had right in a row, and when I was looking for help in dealing with what was going on, I was met with such humility, and I was met with such caring and gratitude and encouragement. In this case, the church hierarchy validated my feelings, and it listened to my fears, teaching me that my experience was important. The church contributed to my original hurt. It was fundamental in that, no question. But it was also instrumental in my healing. Yet again, we are looking at a pinata of mixed contents. Thumbtacks that challenged my marriage and endangered my sense of self, but also candy and sparkling jewels that gave me the faith to trust God, trust my body, trust my marriage, and care for my own needs. It's all mixed together. This is a complex issue for the church. It's been a complex issue for me personally, and there's just no getting away from that, I don't think. As we work on creating this resource, we are necessarily biased towards the issues that have mattered most in our lives. I just shared one of my issues with you. But we really, really don't want to stop at the limits of our biases. We want this resource to be as comprehensive as it can possibly be. We want it to be helpful for all the people in all the niches of our community. And for that, we really do need you. So thank you again for joining us today. I hope that you'll feel comfortable here and that you'll feel safe sharing your stories and your thoughts and that you will be hopeful with us. Thank you.
Pretty negative. I don't think that's, I think that's pretty obvious that these are pretty negative words. All of these words were compiled from a marriage, Eternal Marriage Institute manual. These are words that were taken from conference talks and other deliveries given by prophets and general authorities in relationship to sexuality outside of marriage. Some of these are referring to pornography, so the words are a little bit stronger, but all in all, these are references to sexuality that have been given by the leaders of our church. So this is the climate that I grew up in. This is what it felt like to me growing up as a young woman in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I want to just maybe give some concrete examples to everything that we've been talking about so far today. What I'll tell you is delicate and it's personal, but it's in sharing our stories, I think, that we're able to make the changes that need to be made. So I joined the church when I was 11 years old, and I never knew about sexuality. My mom, I don't think, was ever really comfortable talking to me about it, and my dad talked to me about it on occasion, but it wasn't really something that came up very often. So most of my sex education actually came from what I learned at church. And the two things I remember the most, being a young woman in the church, was one that as young women, we are the guardians of virtue. And that's a phrase you may have heard before. It's something that's still thrown around today. Basically, the idea is that young women are in charge of keeping men in line sexually. by the way that we dress and the things that we say and the way that we carry our bodies. And I remember feeling very strongly that I had this sort of this mantle that I was carrying. This was a very important role that I was playing as guardian of virtue. In retrospect, it makes me really sad. But at the time, you know, being a 13 or 14-year-old girl, it seemed like a very important thing to do. The other thing I remember about growing up in Young Women's were these really harmful analogies. Sarah mentioned this briefly, about sexuality. I remember one specifically talking about a piece of gum and chewing it, and the gum was used, and then, you know, my Young Women's leader asking me, "Do you want to eat this gum?" And of course you don't want to eat the gum, because she's been chewing it, it's been in her mouth, and she said, "Well, it's like, this is what your sexuality is like. This is, your purity is this gum, and if you experiment sexually outside of marriage, then you are this chewed piece of gum, and who's going to want that? Who's going to want that sort of chewed up piece of gum?" You know, and again, being young and impressionable, and also being, you know, a people pleaser and wanting to do the right thing, I really took these things to heart and embodied these things. And it wasn't until I was a little bit older, probably in my late teens, where I was really, really curious about sexuality. And I think this is the time when really deep feelings of shame set in. And I remember, you know, the bishop giving talks about the law of chastity, or even going in and talking to my bishop and getting temple reckonings. And these are the words that I remember hearing. I remember hearing words like unholy, filthiness, sorrow, lasciviousness, and all of these things associated with sexuality. Now, what is sexuality? Sexuality is this divine, God-given gift that we have to be creators, to create universes, to create our posterity. Sexuality is a manifestation of our inner divinity. And I think when we associate it with these kinds of words, it becomes, for women, I can speak as a woman, it becomes very internalized. I've talked to some of my male friends, and I'm curious when we open it up to a Q&A, I'm curious to hear men's experiences with this. But the men I've talked to, most of them have said that they didn't internalize it as much. They didn't internalize these words or associate these words with their sexuality. I've talked with a lot of women who very much internalized these kinds of words and associated these words with their sexuality. So here I am, a young woman trying to do the right thing, feeling like sex is basically the worst thing that could ever happen, the sin next to murder kind of idea, right? And I get married. And I don't know much about sex. I know how it works, but I don't know much about expectations and what's healthy and what's normal. And so I found myself in a marriage that was very abusive, sexually abusive. And again, I didn't have the words to talk about it. I didn't have the words to express what felt wrong to me. Something was wrong. I knew something was wrong, but I didn't have the words to talk about it. And Chelsea's going to share a story in a few minutes about another woman she knows who didn't have the words to express her own sexual abuse. So I found myself in this situation, and marriage, it's going on for months and months and months, and finally I get the courage to talk to my mom about what's happening. And of course, she's kind of stunned, right, that I've been in this marriage and I've been experiencing this kind of abuse. And it was nice to be validated. It was nice to talk to my mom and find out that what I was feeling, the sort of the sadness and the isolation and the shame that I was feeling, was normal to feel for somebody who's been abused, that I wasn't the crazy one, right? Now, I don't want to blame the church. I don't want to blame my parents for not teaching me things that I probably needed to know. But I do want to create an awareness here, to create a space where we can talk about this, and that in not talking about sexuality in a healthy way, there are some very, very serious consequences to that. So my climate wasn't ideal. I want to talk really briefly about what I think the ideal climate would be in terms of healthy sexuality. So the climate I grew up in was very fear-based, right? Sex is shameful. It's dirty. It's an abomination. It's the sin next to murder. Ultimately, it's the most selfish thing you can do outside of marriage, right? I believe sex to be divine, to be a manifestation of a creative force, a manifestation of love, vitality, a manifestation of our humanity. I find sexuality to be the ultimate act of selflessness. I'm thinking also about the law of chastity. Again, the law of chastity. If you break the law of chastity, you're shameful, you're dirty, you're an abomination, you've committed the sin next to murder. And I like to think about the law of chastity as a healthy sexual relationship, a healthy sexual relationship with our spouse. So not just something that we are afraid of breaking before marriage, but something that we think about after we're married. Keeping the law of chastity, I think, is about keeping a healthy sexual relationship with our spouse and a healthy sexual reverence for our own sexuality. What else would I have liked? A safe space. A safe space at church to ask questions and to talk. I think one of the most difficult things for me was going into the bishop's office and sitting in front of this man who was 20 years older than me, who didn't know me from James Smith, and having to share very, very intimate details with him about my sexual self. It feels like a very unhealthy dynamic to me. I don't have the answer to that particular situation right now. One idea I've had, which I would love, is to have women leadership that young women could go to. They need to talk about things in regards to law of chastity. I think that would be much healthier. I remember also the power dynamic of being in the bishop's office. One time I remember confessing something that I had done, and the bishop said to me, "I can't imagine that you have a testimony of the gospel of Jesus Christ, because if you had had a testimony, you wouldn't have done the things you've done." And I didn't know that that was wrong when he said that, and I really internalized it. But it was the very testimony of the gospel of Jesus Christ that brought me to his office in the first place. It was that testimony that brought me there in the first place. I wish I would have had the wherewithal to say that at the time, but I didn't know. I didn't understand. So I would like to see safe places at church where young women can talk about their sexuality, and they can talk about their fears, and they can talk about things that they don't understand. And the last one is a sense of propriety. I remember thinking that masturbation is basically just as bad as having sex outside of marriage. I mean, to me, it was all the same thing. And I think, again, that was just a product of not having a very clear sexual education. So I would like to see sort of a sense of really serious sexual sins in comparison to things that are pretty normal in growing up and understanding yourself sexually. And then in terms of shifts that I would have liked to see in my family, just I would have liked an environment where I could have asked questions honestly without embarrassment. And I wish my parents would have talked to me about birth control as well as abstinence. So those are some things I would like to see. Again, I'm not a parent, so I'm not contributing to this discussion as someone who's advising parents on how they should raise their children, but I do want to share my experience as a child, as a young woman, as an adult woman now, and things that I would have liked to have seen differently from my own experience. So now I'll turn the time over to Chelsea. Right. First of all, I know that talks between parents and children regarding sex are difficult. I think everybody knows that. They are difficult. I know that it seems strange for me to say that because I, too, none of us, again, are parents. However, I am a child, and I have had those conversations. And just as a fun fact, I'd like everybody to know, if it brings any relevance to the conversation here, that my mother is here right now sitting on the front row. So, you know, we're aware of some dynamics here. And because we are by no means obligated to share stories of our sex lives, by no means obligated to share stories of our sex lives with our children, and as Dan Savage says, if there are things your parents have the right not to know. So I'm going to tell you a brief story or a few brief stories, and I want you to know that one of them is mine. Which one is not important. So I am motivated here to work on this project because of stories. I've collected stories of couples who get married without mentioning sex at all before marriage and being wholly incompatible. I have stories of LDS members who feel ashamed of their sexual desires
feeling like they're corrupted for having them at all, even after marriage. I have stories of wedding nights being like thoughtless one-way transactions out of ignorance and of what to do. I have more stories than I care to keep track of LDS members who in their youth made a choice to either shut their sexual selves down, like turn it off, or I've seen them give up facing what they felt like to them to be an unrealistic standard. And it was too high, the bar was too high, and many times we even set the bar above what we have outlined in For the Strength of Youth. Like we say, these are the things that are wrong, these are the things that are sin, keep yourself far away from that. So that gives us another boundary that is arbitrary and higher, and even more intimidating. So I have stories of people who give up, they just don't even try. I have stories of couples who are deeply committed, engaged to be married, who have crossed a line, whether or not they really have, that don't try to come back because the road is impossible to travel and not worth it in their view. And when they're handed the miracle of forgiveness in the bishop's office, they only end up feeling worse about themselves and their situations and their sexual selves. I have one especially heartbreaking story of a woman whose sex education was so poor that she was raped, and she didn't know to call. I'm not saying that she was raped because of her lack of sex education, but she didn't know to call it rape because she didn't have an understanding of what sex was. Like, she literally didn't know what was happening, and that what was happening was a sexual act. And afterwards, she didn't have the language to talk about it with anyone, to tell someone what happened. She didn't know the names of her parts to say, this is what happened, and this is the name of this act that occurred. And I know that that's a really extreme story, but it happened, and it's heartbreaking. I feel like in my life, I've become a magnet for these stories. I think that I've heard them a lot, and I think I'm not of the mindset that we have a heavy-handed God that organizes everything for us. I think that we do much more of that for ourselves. But one way or another, I found myself in positions to be hearing these stories, and I want them to stop. And that's why I'm doing this. So, I want to let you know what resources we are currently using at this stage in our project. This first book is called Keys to Your Child. I have all copies of all of these books if you're interested afterward in perusing or something like that. But we recommend all of these wholly for different purposes. They, as I'll go over in a second, they're just not the resource that we ultimately want. So the first is Keys to Your Child's Healthy Sexuality. This is a wonderful resource. It is not by an LDS author, so the gospel perspective is missing. It does have a superb explanation of how to identify the morals for your family. So it's not prescriptive. It says figure out what's important to you and figure out how to teach that, and here are the tools to do that. It's really, really wonderful. It's arranged by topic, so it's quick, easy reference. If you read the whole thing and then you run into an issue with your child, then you can go have a refresher real fast. The second is How to Talk to Your Child About Sex. This is sold in Deseret Book, so it's widely used among LDS parents. While the authors are LDS, the message isn't necessarily, it reflects LDS values, but it doesn't use any gospel sources or anything like that. One very significant strength of this book is that it models conversations. In talking with parents, that's one of the most difficult things. It's just like, I want to do this, I want to give them the information, I just don't know how. And the children that don't, the parents can answer questions all the time. And the child asks a question and they answer it. But I think there are far more children who don't bring it up, and the parents don't know how to start the conversation. So that book has models of how to do that with your child that is very helpful, and it is quite thorough. Some things we don't love about this book is that some of the teachings are out of sync with the readers. It's pretty conservative. and the adolescence section seems quite clunky. And I myself cannot imagine having children that would respond to the conversations that they bring up in adolescence. So also there's one... one of the other defining characteristics of that book and their theory is that you should answer questions for of your children's on a need-to-know basis up to age 8. And then at age 8, you have like a larger talk and then follow up from there. But anyway, that's not a bad approach, but it's not appropriate for everyone. And this book, again, is prescriptive. It lays it out saying, this is the best way to do things, and here's the step along the way. Every step along the way. And They Were Not Ashamed is actually not a parent's resource, but it is by now the author. It uses gospel resources. It is wonderful. I fully support the message and fully support the approach. It is very love-based. The thing that doesn't work so much, the reason this doesn't fit what we're really looking for, is that it is not, it is for parents. It's for repairing things rather than prevention in the first place of these gospel problems, these problems. So, does that make sense?
It does have a section, but it's like an afterthought.
Yes, so the bulk of the book is for adults who already have issues that they're trying to work through, rather than preparing your children to not have those issues in the first place. And then there is a section for how to talk to your kids about sex, but it's in just one small section at the end of the book. The very last is Parents Guide. Sarah talked about that a little bit. It is church published. It specifically addresses sex education. The strengths in this is it is a great format. It teaches values and parenting techniques, and then three age groups. So like toddler age, preteen age, and teenager age. It's probably my favorite resource out of the three. It's most like what we're looking to do. However, the title is a parent's guide. It could mean anything. And I don't think that parents are getting the resource in their homes and in their heads. I honestly stumbled across it. None of the three of us had ever experienced it before in all of our research and all of the years of us just being concerned with this ourselves. I in preparing for this panel, I went to the distribution center and basically just pulled down a whole wall of family resources. And it ended up in there. And I opened the first page and I was like, oh, it's going to address sexuality. But then I didn't even realize then that it was the whole volume. So I don't think it's being, until I read it. So it's not being distributed like it could be. The parents aren't getting the message. It was published in the 80s with talks older than that. And we're not ones to believe that things get outdated just because they get old. But there have been changes in policy. There have been changes in perspective since then, and it's not reflected in that book. I contacted the curriculum committee about this week, about the book, and they have no plans to update it as of right now. If they have plans to update it, I again would consider like maybe this isn't necessary. Maybe we can just hang on, but they're content with that one. So. And lastly, this book, it's a thin volume, and it, for the most part, offers rules but not tools. So it says these are the standards, these are the things that you should teach your children, that they should, the abstinence and whatnot, but it doesn't give tools of how to help your child remain abstinent, if that makes sense. So it throws the topics out there that doesn't help with how to get those done. So, in Sarah's section of the presentation, she mentioned that our goal is to promote the existing love-based messages of the gospel. One element of our resource will include a topic-based guide, much like Tree of the Faith or the Gospel Principles Manual, but addressing sex ed topics by issues by topic. I've chosen just a few of these for illustration, just to show you what we're looking to do. And by and large, we plan to present scientific, psychological, and doctrinal perspectives for each topic. However, some of the topics will not have comments from all three sources, as all three perspectives may not be relevant. Like we don't necessarily need a scientific perspective on agency. It's really mostly a gospel topic and a psychological topic. So that's what we have here. These are both gospel resources. We have, So in these quotes, we are to teach our children to understand consequences and that at times they need to feel the weight of their decisions. And that helps in the process of, well, we'll just, that's the teaching. We just want to get to discussion. So. And then this is our primary psychological resource, and it expresses the same things. There are consequences that we need to teach our children, or just their existence. And it's a parent's role, and it is not a parent's role to be the sole problem solver. Children need, again, need to feel the weight of their own consequences. And then also the bottom line, just like, it sends a clear message that youngsters are not capable of finding solutions to their own problems, or they're not able to trust themselves and their decisions that they're making. Then we have, for instance, anatomy. This, again, is gospel principles. Use the correct names without it, because it will prevent unnecessary embarrassment. And then we have our psychological resource saying, teach your children the right words. Otherwise, your children will sense that something's not quite right, or send a message that things are unspeakably private or shameful. So some of these topics, everything is totally in line, and we like complementing. I'm already saying head shaking, I'm so excited. They are moderately in line. And then there are other issues where things are not clear cut. And this slide actually is empty. I don't have anything to put on it at this point. And the reason, and this leads us to what we're really looking to do here today. We again want your help. We are women, all three of us. We are not parents. We are all under the age of 35. There are lots of experiences that we need to hear about in order to have a more comprehensive guide that we don't have right now. The thing that we want to accomplish today is to hear your stories. Whether you are a youth and you're dealing with this learning process right now, you are a mother or father of 10 sending your last down the aisle, or you're experiencing sex in a different way with maturity that you really wish others would know about as they're going through their younger years. We want to hear of your advice, your cautionary tales, your silly memories, your concerns, and all of this with the long-term goal of creating a resource that members of the Mormon community can really benefit from. Obviously, we don't have time to do all of this right now. Absolutely not. So this is a list of topics that we, this is by no means comprehensive. This is just a list that we have worked up so far. And I will go back to this, and this is our email address. I want you to be assured that privacy is number one. The only people who will ever read these emails will be ones sitting up here on the panel, unless we were to secure other blessing. So if you have stories that you'd like to share with us, you share them now. If you just have comments and not looking for a response, send those in. Also, if you would like to contribute in a larger way, you'd like to help us write some things, if you know someone who does web publishing and we do that yourself and you'd like to contribute in that sort of way, let us know in this email. And then also, you can also just send us an email, even if you don't have anything to contribute right now, and we can, as we're getting closer to different steps in the resource, we can let you know, just this is where we are, and the website's up if you want to look at that, those sorts of things. So we are now going to open this for questions. Please, do we have another microphone?
Yes.
Okay, we have another microphone. Please use the microphone. Comments are totally welcome, as are questions. If you're making, you're just trying to be as concise as possible, because the more that we hear from everyone, the better, more solid this will be. And Chris Ann specifically had a question that she wanted to pose to the group, and that is, we would like to specifically hear, most of us talk with women. We haven't heard a lot from men. We've talked with, you know, husbands and brothers, but that's still only a small circle, especially culturally and that sort of thing. So, do you want to rephrase your question again?
Oh, sure.
So I mentioned it briefly when I was talking earlier. I'm just curious if anybody's comfortable in sharing what their experiences were with the climate that they grew up with, their sexuality, if they internalized sort of all those shame-based words that we had on the slide earlier, or if that was not an issue.
I thought it was interesting that the perception was that women internalize more than the men, and maybe
in general that's true, I don't know. I only know my own experiences, but I was raised in a very straight-laced, rigid, true blue Mormon household. Both parents, very strong. Also loving, you know, there were hugs and kisses after family prayer, etc. So nothing particularly strenuous going on in that area, but the sexual education was severely lacking. I think there may have been two conversations in my youth at all that centered on those details, and certainly not in a depth that was useful to me. Very broad strokes. But as far as the impact from the teachings of the church throughout my youth, there was plenty of that. And I don't have any memories of there being loving or encouraging or building type of information. So what I was filled with were basically that slide of words. I was filled with those thoughts and ideas and concepts and related those to my sexual identity. So at the age of 12, when I discovered the marvels of masturbation, I knew at that point that I had crossed the line of no return, that I was no longer loved by God, and that there was no return. And this was so solid and concrete to me that even after talking to bishops and, you know, confessing and trying to follow the path of righteousness and repentance and things like that, I believed more in the damnation that was upon me than I did in any type of repentance or atonement or anything. There was no comparison. The damnation was so thick and so heavy and so strong. So from my personal experience, that impacted me and colored my adolescence so heavily that I lost all hope at that point, and realistically never got it back until I decided to disassociate my identity from my religious upbringing and start anew. That's how significant the damage was. So in response to your question, from a male perspective, that's the impact it had on me. So hopefully that helps.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. That's actually really good to hear.
Just that I think I've gotten that impression before. Like, I don't remember any lesson ever in Young Women's that addressed masturbation with the assumption that girls or women would have to confront that. I think probably in some wards, many wards, who knows, that is really, really emphasizing among young men. And that there are consequences to that, absolutely. Thank you very much for sharing that.
I was just going to say, I think a lot of the perceived difference, I forget which one of you said it, but one of you said that women internalize it more than men. I think part of it is that there's a huge gender divide in the method of teaching. There's a point where the guys hear the same words so much that they almost shut off. But at the same time, you know, the same parents will allow their boys in water polo to wear Speedos while their girls can't even wear, you know, one piece that's not going to cover the legs. So there's a point where it's taught so negatively on both sides, but there's other double standards that I don't think it touches the guys as much, and I think the guys have more of a tendency to be hostile to the negative teachings than they do to actually look inside themselves. One of the best examples, I think it was interesting, when I was a priest, I actually came up with an idea to do a different kind of chastity lesson. I had just read the Holland Talk, which was like the only one that had anything positive in it. And
soul symbols and sacraments?
Yes. And what we did is we invited a woman and a man to talk combined to all the youth, and it ended up being one of the most ridiculous activities that I had as a, I remember staying till like 3 a.m. yelling in the bishop's office, because, I mean, the woman who spoke was a nurse, and she taught like the biological principles. She went over actually some of the, you know, safe sex things, and it was great. And then like the difference of what the man addressed and how there was a gender divide in addressing the group as a whole, like I. I'm sure you guys have all seen it. He just went off. It was one of those, you know, like pornography is bad, masturbation is bad, guys can't control them. So just any bad stereotypical, you know, damnation Mormon guys are hypersexualized beings that can't control themselves.
I think that very sort of entrenched stereotype is really problematic, again, because it's almost always coupled with women somehow not being sexual or that sexual, and therefore they are the guardians of young men's virtue because they are so hypersexual, right? Which is so obviously really problematic.
When you set it up that way, it almost has an opposite effect in reality, because neither of them know how to deal with the non-sexual or the sexual when it appears.
Right, yeah.
I just want to mention something else very briefly. No, go ahead, take the mic. I forgot to mention that the ones with asterisks, those are ones that we are especially anxious about, obviously. So, carry on.
I'm just wondering about the culture, the Mormon culture in terms of sexuality, and whether or not some of our history that we like to keep within our shadows or in the closet prevent us really from addressing these issues, because then, as we do, then we have to bring out things that occurred long ago. The other thing is, I was informed by my brothers and sister about 5 years ago that I'm the firstborn child. Turned out that my mother and father had a very short period between the time that they were married and when I was born.
You were premature.
There's two ways of looking at that, or I'm the only love child. My mother was told by her mother never to tell anyone, the bishop, the state president. She's carried that with her entire life. And that has colored her approach to sexuality and being very, projecting out a very harsh attitude towards it. And keeping kids way from it. It's had the opposite effect in the second generation, in my nephews and nieces. So I'm wondering if this is a systemic problem within the church, where there's a larger cultural issue within our community that keeps us from really addressing these issues.
Yeah, I want to respond to that. The story I shared about going to the bishop's office and the bishop telling me that if I really like a testimony of the gospel of Jesus Christ, I wouldn't have sinned in the way that I had. And I remember something else that he told me was that I was not to tell anyone at all what had happened. And again, I think that really reinforced for me a sense of shame and secrecy. I didn't follow that counsel, actually. I conferred with some really close women friends because I needed that support. I needed other women in my circle to help me feel safe when I was going through this really difficult time. So I think it is a systemic problem. I do, yeah.
I think I must have heard, you know, the stories about the chew gum and lip cupcakes and because they're familiar to me, but I managed to somehow get through adolescence without internalizing them. I don't know how it happened. But now, so I'm a parent, and I have four small boys. And I hear stories way too often about, well, my son was at the pool, and there were all these sluts in bikinis, and my son had to leave because he couldn't be there. And I don't want my boys to grow up viewing women, you know, I don't care what they're wearing. I do not want my boys to grow up viewing women as sluts. I don't want that to be the focus. I want them, I've had some discussion, actually, with my brother a little bit and some other people. about, you know, how do we teach boys to look beyond that? Because yes, they're going to see things, and yes, they're going to be attracted to that, and that's normal. And we should teach them that that's normal. But we also need them to give, we need to give them tools to look beyond that, so that's not all they're focusing on, and so we don't feel like they have to run away, you know, when something like that comes up. So that's something that I would like to see addressed, and I don't know if anyone has any thoughts on that. But
you said I didn't want your boys to look at women as
sluts.
Because of what they're apparel.
I don't want them to be labeling, and I don't want their feelings about what girls are wearing to override everything else. Like, they don't know how to deal with girls because they can't look beyond, I'm sexually attracted to this girl, and that's wrong, and I have to run away. I don't think that's giving them good coping skills for life.
Yeah, I just want to respond to that briefly if somebody else wants to as well. But in another panel, it may have been the roundtable yesterday or something, but there was talk of that same sort of idea that there is something in the Mormon church's culture that we have a really hard time, men and women have a really hard time relating to each other non-sexually. And that may sound strange out of context, so I don't know if you were on that panel, but I think there is an element to that, and it may be that same fixation on sex, that's when we go to separate classrooms, we have separate conversations in church. We, even adults, the adults have their separate meetings, and when we, I just don't know if that may be a part of this issue, and there's all sorts of counsel of, you know, never being alone with a member of the opposite sex. Like, I don't think that we do a fantastic job of teaching our children to interact with the opposite sex that's not sexual. Seems like so much of the relations that we talk about are, you know, the day before you're 16, like it all seems to be sexualized association. So maybe it needs to be a break from that, or that's a particle of it.
I just wanted to very quickly say that I think that is a huge problem, and thank you so much for bringing that up, because as feminists, we really, really want to address that. And I think that the church, even though we have a problem with it very clearly, I think that our established appreciation for agency and also the value of respect in terms of sexual education really lend themselves very well to addressing that and teaching our children to respect people for their whole selves and not just for their sexual capacities.
I think, going on what she said, that modesty is very much taught in the church. We're taught to be very superficial and taught to really care about our appearance because that somehow shows how spiritual we are. But, you know, how if our shorts come down to our knees or if they come just above, you know, or if we have sleeves or if we don't have sleeves. And I have a 2-year-old little girl, and for her to wear a sleeveless dress is not a big deal. But we somehow make that like that really matters, and there's nothing sexual about a 2-year-old's shoulders, you know, and there's nothing sexual about a 14-year-old's shoulders, but we make it this big deal, and we worry about it, and because we keep saying no, 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 or this is bad, we make it a scary thing, and we always almost make something sexual, you know? I nurse, and a breast is for nursing, that's what it's made for, you know? And it goes into our view of how we see things. If I were to just whip out a nurse right here, would you think sexually, or would it just be a natural thing because that's what they're made for? And there's this view that we have, we make it scary, we make things sexual when they don't need to be. It's our mindset. So part of it is just addressing that mindset of it's not scary, it's okay. I didn't internalize that much growing up, but I had a great experience with an older cousin. She was with her brother and her brother's boyfriend, and she told me this happened about when I was 18. He's a few years older than me, and she's like 10 years older than me. They were at the beach, and they were swimming, and one of her younger brothers pants this older brother, and his girlfriend was there, and she just covered her eyes, and, oh my gosh, don't know, you know, kind of freaked out about seeing his penis. And they were dating to get married. And my cousin made an awesome comment to me. She said that it doesn't really matter. So what you thought, you know, so what that she thought she shouldn't have freaked out like that, because you're going to see it someday. You're planning on marrying him. You know, it's not that big a deal. But we make things scary when they don't need to be scary.
A comment and then a story, I guess. First of all, great idea for a project. I'm really excited to see this being addressed. I don't think it'll make a church-wide impact until they change the manuals. When you look at the Young Men's Manual, the lessons are becoming a good man, being a leader, being a good man, rejecting, like, becoming a whole person. Where you look at the Young Women's Manual and it's being a wife, being a mother, and you're not whole if you are not those two things. And everything that relates to that is protecting your sexuality and protecting your virtue and protecting the men's virtue around you by not dressing like walking pornography, as I said in general conference. and I think until that is addressed, there will not be a church-wide change, because most Mormon families don't talk to their kids about sex. They expect it to be addressed in Young Men's and Young Women's and Morals and Standards, right, whatever it's called now. Second of all, but I do think this is a great project that needs to be done. Second of all, my sister told me the other day about this story that happened in their ward, where the young men were uncomfortable with how the young women were dressing. And rather than talk to the young men about controlling their own thoughts or saying that they can only be responsible for themselves, they let the young men address the young women in their ward and tell them that the way that they were dressing was making them uncomfortable to talk to them. And I asked her, I said, well, what are they showing up to activities in? Are they naked? Are they in swimsuits? What's the problem? And she said, well, they're coming after their sports activities and they're wearing shorts that are shorts and garments and they're wearing sometimes tank tops. And she thought it was just fabulous that these young men would address the problem. And I turned it around and I said, since when does how somebody else dress affect your actions towards them? And it was a way that she'd never thought of it before. And I think that I totally agree with the hammering on the modesty, modesty, modesty. You forget that the moral of the message is not dress modest so that the guy next to you doesn't lose all control and rape you and it's your fault now. The message of modesty is respecting your body and respecting yourself, and it has nothing to do with anybody else around you. And until that changes, it's not an issue. And one more story really fast. I think it needs to be addressed with bishops also. I had a friend who recently was raped and had a resulting pregnancy. And after changing wards and discussing with her bishop, he, since she was unmarried and pregnant, revoked her temple recommendation. And told her that since she wasn't giving the child to LDS Social Services, that she could not have a recommend until within a year since she had had sex. And discussing this with my bishop in horror, my bishop sent me the handbook instructions, which are very explicit that rape is not the fault of the victim, but victims may feel guilty because of the... but apparently this message didn't make it to her bishop. And I think until bishops realize the church's stand on sexuality and that rape is not a sex crime, rape is a hate crime or a violent crime, that problem is going to perpetuate. And she's an adult, and she didn't see anything wrong with the situation until I pointed it out. And then supposedly it was resolved with her state president.
Well, that's somewhat great. I'm happy that it's here.
It wasn't until within a year already. So, yeah. But I hope for guilt, I hope it was resolved a little bit.
We can leave those as comments mostly, but there's a bunch of slides that we didn't use, but there was one that I wanted to share because it responded to something you said. But now we can't find it. Okay, maybe this won't work. But Okay, maybe I deleted it entirely, so never mind. And now I can't even remember. Now I've forgotten it because I was just sure I would find it. What was your first comment?
About the changing of the curriculum or about the boys addressing the girls' modesty?
Actually, you know what it was? And I'll mention something else after this. But there is a quote in one of the gospel, or in one of, it was a talk actually, that states very directly that it is the church programs are secondary, if not tertiary, or further down the line, to the home. And this is in a gospel resource. And it's things like that that we want to try and share with people so that maybe parents and church leaders will understand that that's not the responsibility. The responsibility needs to come from the home, and maybe that will come across somewhere. Sarah and I have actually been approached here at Sunstone. LDS Wave is very soon going to be making booklets that will... manuals of some kind that will hopefully be distributed to bishops in themselves. And we're thinking of, we were approached about possibly trying to get a preliminary sort of one ready on chastity. On chastity specifically. So anyway, that's
hopefully.
Does someone have
the mic? Sorry. Again, this is great. I appreciate this project you're doing. I wish you the best of luck. A comment and a question. The comment is kind of related to this gentleman who made the first comment. I think that today, with the advent of the internet, cell phone, and pornography, that men and women, but particularly men, I think that the percentage of men in the church, young men who are going to wrestle with sexual guilt and all this is going to be such a high percentage of the church. And it's just going to be, I think it's an overwhelming problem. And it's, I have no idea how to address it. But that's my comment. I think there's a crisis looming here. My comment, though, is that I have two 15-year-old twin daughters. Last night, my daughter, I picked her up from EFY, and she told me what cow meant. And it means crush of the week. So she's getting into this, you know, she's starting to have these feelings. And I'm just wondering... this is a scary landscape to navigate my daughters through this. Do you have any advice? What should I go home and talk to my daughters about, the two 15-year-olds?
So I mentioned that I didn't get a lot of sex education growing up, but I think the most sex education I got was from my dad, actually. I think number one is being non-judgmental and just being a safe space. So your daughter can feel comfortable coming to you and asking questions. And I think it's okay if she asks something that makes you uncomfortable, I think it's okay to say, yeah, I'm going to think about that. Can I get back to you? And then getting back to her later that day. So it doesn't become something that's a source of embarrassment or shame or secrecy, right? But that would be my advice, my own experience, is just being a safe place where she can come and ask questions and not feel judged, really.
Just briefly, I have a very bold memory of when I was about 9 years old, my parents coming into my bedroom and waking me up together, and it was because they had been watching on the news about Matthew Shepard, the young man in Laramie, Wyoming, who had been killed, this will be related, who had been killed for being gay, and my parents just wanted to tell me that they loved me no matter what, and that there was nothing that I could do that was wrong enough to make them stop loving me. And that was something that I knew, I guess in a way, but there is something very powerful about having the words said directly to your face. And so I have no idea what sort of environment you have in your home about, you know, being open with each other or wanting your children to know that they can come and talk to you. But I would just encourage you to maybe have that face-to-face thing of, I really care about your life and all the aspects of it, and I want you to know that you can come to me and that I want you to. I think that that can be very powerful. The woman in the vest has been like, so maybe right after, and then we'll go, it seemed like everything was getting mixed up.
Yeah, if we can get the microphone to the woman in the white shirt, the vest, she has to be one of
the best. Go ahead. I wanted to just make a quick comment. Also, I would absolutely recommend picking up a parent guide at the distribution centers. It's on, if you have an iPhone and you have the gospel, I can't remember what it's called, but it has a little link in your own eye. Like, it's online, it's everywhere. Read that over, it's small, and there's
there's some very nice things in there. So some things not so nice, but you're at Sunstone, so I assume you'll be fine in discerning most of yourself.
You mentioned that your page on the gaze was blank. I had just a couple of suggestions for resources. One would be William Bradshaw. He's a professor emeritus at BYU in microbiology. He's an exhibition president. He's had many church callings. He has a gay son. He gives many lectures on the physical differences between gays and the rest of us. His son is now married. He and his partner hit the deadline in California when they could get married. And they have a daughter. And they're raising that daughter very, very finely. The partner has a doctor's degree, I don't remember what. His son, I think, has a master's degree. I just think that could be an example of what's going on. Now, I think he could be a resource maybe in deciding maybe he could really see that. I think he could also be a resource in directing you to the people who are homosexual and the problems they have had.
With how the church has...
Yes, in the church, growing up. So I just throw that out. He lives in Oregon.
Right. I'd actually mentioned he's...
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. Well, then you're already on top. But in addition to that, just a comment. I don't think you can solve this problem, but it's come up. And that is, I have great admiration for most bishops and most counselors. And yet they're a lay, untrained group of people. And we have learned in our family just in the last few years that spiritual abuse is a reality. And it's often unintended, but it is a reality in our church. And I don't know how you can address that, but it comes up very often in the subject you're going into.
Yes. And you don't think that's
something we really do want to address. Yeah, I know. I got a few things. One thing, let me just say, talking about sex for me is that it's like the next best thing to sex. So this is great. Also, I feel like one of the things I've done, I haven't been great necessarily educating my kids, but I think one thing that if I've done something right, it is having a certain gusto for sex. And I think that's, in terms of them having a healthy sexuality, I think that's probably my biggest contribution. Let's see where I go with that. This is, I guess, a response to something that was said. I would consider myself a failure, and I don't think I will, but I would, if I raised a son to think of women's breasts as primarily for feeding their kids. Well, let me just say that. I don't want my son to think of his wife's breasts, should my son turn out to be heterosexual, that's still a little, we're not sure yet, but anyway, that's not how I primarily want, or solely how I want him to look at women's breasts. He won't get mine that way. But also, there seems to be, I think some of the women here seem to have the same naivete that I have for a long time. I've been embarrassed to admit this to some point, and I kind of blamed it on not having brothers, but I'm not sure that's what it was. How long it took me to really appreciate what testosterone means and what hormones mean and the difference it means to have testosterone, large amounts of it running through your veins or wherever it runs, versus a small amount that women have. And the book's been recommended the male brain, maybe especially recommended for women. And I think we need to appreciate how much more visual men are. And I don't think that women largely do appreciate that. Or I think we might act sometimes and dress maybe, I don't know, a little differently. I have a little more respect for men, I feel. That's my take on it. schools for a number of years, and I really felt like there's a big gap in the sex ed that's taught in the schools, and I was so disappointed to see that I feel like you have the same gap. And to me, a big part of sex is the emotional and relationship part of it, and that's a real misunderstood part, especially as teenagers, and I think a different way in terms of how men and women do with sex, and why men tend to do so much better with the one-night stand than girls do, or women, and I don't see a category for that, and that concerns me deeply, and I'm almost done here. But just the last thing, it's not the most important, but I just to acknowledge, it's didn't mean to be too disrespectful, shaking my head negatively about the genitalia thing, and I was glad for Nathan sitting next to me to explain to me where you may be coming from. I feel like, hey, if my son wants, I don't want my son to go around always using penis and never using dick. I mean, that's not important to me. But he made a great point. He says, hey, in our family, a vagina, that wasn't said, or that it was a doily. And now, because I said, I don't think a dick is a
thing. That was my mother's family.
Oh, the mother's, okay, well, the mother's side. So I said, why would a dick? Because the logic you were giving wasn't working for me from the psychologist or the church. I thought, why would a guy be embarrassed because he didn't use penis, he used dick? I don't get why that would be embarrassing. But then I thought, oh yeah, if you started talking at school about doilies, about, you know, parts of the women, that would be embarrassing. So anyway, I was glad for that clarification. Anyway,
no, that's very good. And I will say, for my part, the thing about it is that I was never taught the word vagina, or in my family, any euphemistic word for any of my private parts. It was like they didn't exist. And for my brothers, there was one euphemistic word for their penises, but never the word penis. I think it's just a question of saying, I'm going to teach you the names of all the parts of your body except for this circle right here, that we're not going to even acknowledge that. I'm fine, I have some favorite euphemisms of my own, you know, and I think they're great, but I think from the perspective of, like, looking at teaching your child about their body, it's important that they see that that is a part of their body that's wonderful, just like their hands and their ears and everything else. That was me.
Knowledge, basically. I agree too that it's not necessarily the only one that can be used at all, but it's just knowing, having a basis to know this is what it is called medically, scientifically, maybe this is what we'll call it in this specific situation. Just knowing, just like anything else, just like I personally in my family, my children, even though I will, for the most part, hope that they remain absent and they will know what abortion is, and they will know what birth control methods are, and they will know, they still should know all of these things, even if they're not used in their life for whatever reason. And thank you for bringing up the emotional component. Again, like I said, this is not a comprehensive list. We know we have a long way to go. So thank you for that, especially.
Yeah, I just wanted to echo what was said earlier about the cycle of shame. You know, for me growing up when I was 12, 13, my sex education was miracle forgiveness. Here, go read this. And then, you know, when you're 19 years old on a mission, the missionaries, right, 90% of them feel that the reason they're not baptized is because they're probably masturbating. And I feel like guilt goes over. So someone mentioned earlier, too, how do we break that cycle? It's almost insurmountable. Well, as I go, I'm a 12-year-old boy, you know, so this is why I came here today. But I already told my wife, hey, there should be nothing that Bishop talks to my son about that I can't talk to him about. That he shouldn't feel like he needs to talk to this. He's a good guy. Irish is great, very soft, good person. But he should talk to me first and feel comfortable talking to his father first. So that's kind of my suggestion. Well, as you write this book and you develop these steps, also kind of keep that open for parents to have the courage to talk to their bishops and say, you know what, I don't feel comfortable talking to my son about touching himself. That's really not your place. I mean, I know what the church may say, but you also have, as a parent, the veto power overall.
And I mean, I was asked that question by my bishop when I was a 12-year-old as well, and I think that there's like a extra layer of inappropriateness on that. I think that that's a really good point and something we'll definitely want to improve in the council, to be like, these children are part of your family. They are not the bishop's charge or, you know, something. This is important that you get involved.
And that's in harmony with the idea of the home being the first place you go to before the institution of church.
Really glad that you're doing this project. I think it can be really helpful, and I'll be glad to help out. I could say a bunch of things. I'm going to say one little story on masturbation. I think Mike has talked about here in terms of male sexuality. I'm 42. I experienced the same type of deep shame and deep internalized shame, not just in the church, but even in the culture. I don't think it's so much that way now. I don't think boys tease each other and are really mean and cruel to each other over you masturbate. But that was really big when I was a teenager growing up. And my sense is in the church, a lot of bishops are probably around my age or younger, some older. And so I think what they teach about masturbation is what they knew growing up and what they learned in the church growing up. I think if you look very carefully in how masturbation is talked about in the LDS church now, very, very little is ever said. The Parents Guide, which is 1985, has very specific things about masturbation that we don't teach anymore. And those are some of the destructive things in the Parents Guide, I think. I think what it teaches about masturbation is unhealthy, is destructive, and simply leads to shame and guilt that is not effective. And then I'll tell a little story. My ward recently did a short youth conference. It was a 3-day youth conference just for the ward. And they did a rafting trip. And I'm the financial secretary in the ward. And I overheard one of the bishopric members talking. And he said, I went to 4 churches to find this video. And I was standing right there, and I said, oh, I'm curious, what is it? And he said, it's Morality for Youth, the 1981 production of a rafting trip that teaches kids about sexual morality, or just always called morality, never sexual morality in church. And when he said that, they were going to show it on this youth trip, and they're like, oh, this is kind of cool. We're going to do a rafting trip, and we're going to show this video. And so I actually wrote kind of a lengthy email expressing my concern that this is a 1981 video. I remember seeing it when I was a kid. I don't remember what it was about. I remember it was a very, very silent meeting when they showed it to us, though. And I remember at that time, President Kimball and others had some very strong, harsh, shame-inducing language about masturbation and about sexual morality in general. And so I was very concerned in my email. I said, I don't know if this is the best thing to share with the youth. I don't know if this, I just was really cautioned, showing an almost 30-year-old, or actually this 30-year-old, that may not be healthy for, it's not what we teach now, it's not what's in this for the strength of youth now, and it may not, I just would encourage them to really look at it very carefully. And they were nice about it, and they told me afterward, thanks for your email, and they were friendly about it and stuff, and they were concerned that I was concerned, but they showed it anyway. They felt like it was good, and that the bishop said, well, it doesn't teach anything in there that I don't talk about with the youth, and it all seemed appropriate. And one of them said, I don't think it has some of the harsh language that President Kimball was known for. We didn't see any of that in it. But I don't know. I couldn't find the transcript online anywhere, so I don't really know exactly what's in it. But I think that the intense shame and guilt that's around masturbation, especially for young men, which is not at all talked about usually for young women, I think is an epidemic, is a crisis, is a building crisis. I think the majority of LDS men and probably LDS women of the rising generations have a lot of guilt and shame around sexuality in general and maybe masturbation specifically, and I think that's going to be a huge thing to address.
Well, yeah, I just want to thank the men. Thank you so much for sharing
very honestly and openly your feelings and experiences growing up with your sexuality, because I actually haven't heard men be this open about it and talk about their experiences, so thank you for that.
You may have heard the bell chime. That means that we are actually out of time and a little over. Thank you again so much, those of you who shared, those of you who listened and had your own thoughts that you kept to yourself. We want to remind you, can you click forward to the next? We want to the Gmail. Oh, good. We want to remind you to send us emails if you want to contribute something, help in any way, or just raise a concern, anything that you have in mind. And also to corner us throughout the rest of the symposium, you know, that's fine as well. Thank you again, and we hope that you have a pleasant evening and remain symposium.